Hey, everybody. It is Glenn Thrush with this week's Off Message podcast. So last week, I wanted to have a little bit of a spiritual antidote. We talked to the former astronaut, Mark Kelly, because sometimes, guys, you just got to talk to an astronaut. You just got to see Neil Armstrong putting that American flag on the moon to remind yourself that, you know, what this country actually is. The other thing I wanted to do, and you know, we could have campaign officials on from both campaigns if we'd like. We could have kind of players. We had some media folks who had some interest in coming on this week. But this close to the election, this deep in the red zone, people get really cautious. It doesn't really lend itself to the kind of podcast I like to do where people are a little more relaxed and talk about stuff. So I got to thinking, what do I want to listen to? What do I want to hear about right now? And what I want to know, and I want to give a shout out to my friend Sasha Eisenberg, who wrote a really great book on data and analytics a couple of years ago. What I want to know is how that process, the real under the hood stuff that makes campaigns work or not work, how that is proceeding now, and a real explainer for those of us who cover it and listen to it and are into it, a real explainer on how it works step by step. I think a lot of people who are political junkies and dig this stuff don't really understand how all of its works. Kind of like watching football every Sunday and not understanding how an offense or a defense works. So we got two really, really smart Democratic and Republican data folks, data analytics folks to chat with us today. And one of the things that really stuck out for me was how they viewed each individual voter from a marketing perspective. I know most people generally know how this works, but I think it's very interesting to hear how they score voters based on their propensity, their likelihood to actually get out and vote, and their likelihood to support a particular candidate. It is the combination of those things, those two factors, that really determine how much money a campaign puts into each individual voter and how they try to persuade them. The other thing that we talked a lot about and is very important are early voting and absentee voting. And it seems at this moment, from looking at the data, that the Clinton campaign has a distinct advantage, particularly in the state of North Carolina. Things are a little muddier in places like Florida and Iowa, and stuff really gets going in Ohio over the next week or so. But early and absentee voting will account for between 1/3 and 40% of the entire votes cast. So you heard me correctly. If you go to the polling place on Election Day, on November 8th, like I do, only 60% of the country votes that way. 40% of the votes will already have been decided. So all these big news events, like the Anthony Weiner sexting email investigation, whatever the hell you want to call it, are really only having an impact probably right now on 65, 70% of the electorate. So it diffuses the impact of any news event. And the closer we get to the election, the less impact individual news events can have on things. It's very important to understand. This is the way the campaigns think, and this is the way elections are won and lost. First, our regular business. Please follow us on iTunes and rate us. We are also on Spotify. We've been getting some really interesting feedback. Keep the emails coming. I know people are getting very, very intense. The email traffic that I've been getting along with the Twitter traffic has not always been incredibly positive, but it has been intense, and I understand how passionate people are on both sides of the issue here. I think things will chill out, hopefully, knock on wood, by November 9th. Oh yeah, and always, I want to put in a plug for Nerdcast, our companion podcast run by the great Kristen Roberts, who's an editor here. You know, we've got 50-some-odd reporters out in the field, plus another 50 or so who work for Politico Pro who are studying up on all these issues. And she has them on to talk about the impact of the election, how it will work on policy. It's a really, really fascinating discussion, and I recommend it highly. Without any further ado, here are two of the smartest analytics and data guys in the business, Mark Stevenson and John Hagner. Okay, so we're going to start off in kind of a little bit more of a formal way, because this is kind of a special episode of the podcast, kind of an explainer. We're right in the middle of everything. With me to my right, no, who the hell could tell who's to my right, is Mark Stevenson. Mark, tell the folks out there where you work and what you do.
Sure. My firm is called Red Oak Strategic, and we're an analytics and data science firm. We do work for Republican campaigns. We do corporate work, things in the finance world, and try to make sense of data in politics, but also in other industries as well. So,
and we'll have pictures, but I got to say, no one could possibly look the part more than Mark, who's literally sitting in front of an Excel spreadsheet right now with. How would you describe your glasses?
Dark and horn-rimmed, I guess.
I would go nerd hipster, but that's just me.
That's right. My wife picked these out, so I'll give her credit for that.
Warby Parker, ladies and gentlemen. John, tell us a little bit about your firm and what
you do. My firm's called Clarity Campaign Labs, very similar to Mark's, but on the Democratic side. We do data analytics and polling for Democratic and progressive clients in the U.S. and growing international practice. We don't do as much corporate work as Mark's, but lots of do-gooders around the world.
So we're here to talk a little bit about early voting and absentee balloting, which seems to be taking on an added level of prominence with each given campaign. Either one of you, can we just sort of give me a very 40,000-foot overview of how absentee, same day early voting, how this has kind of evolved, and what percentage of the pie are we talking about here?
Yeah, I'll start. Over the last every cycle. Since I've been doing campaigns starting in 2004, early vote has increased in its importance. It's become a larger and larger piece of the electorate. There are some states that, in Washington, Oregon, Colorado, all of the votes come in by mail, so it's 100%. There are states that 3/4 of the vote will be early, and then in a lot of states, it's not nearly as big of a deal. So it varies tremendously across the board. This cycle, we expect we'll get more than 1/3 of the national presidential votes will come in early. But as I said, that's different across the board. Usually, Republicans do better in the mail ballot and Democrats do better in the in-person early vote. Although I think we're starting to see some of those patterns change.
And how was that sort of, which of the parties got on this? Obviously, absentee has been something that Republicans have had an advantage on for a couple of reasons. They have older voters and also overseas armed services people too, right? How have the parties kind of evolved on this and exploited it? And what campaigns really know how to do this?
So absentee early voting is baked in now really to the campaign strategy as sort of early voting starts a couple weeks out, or people can start requesting absentee ballots months out from the election. Folks like John and myself sort of have these models of who we think should be requesting ballots, who we would like to encourage to request a ballot, maybe who hasn't voted. They're sort of a regular voter that if we bank them in as an early voter, that's a value add for the campaign. So the other thing that, in addition to sort of targeting people specifically that we want to make sure we'll vote absentee or vote early, it allows us to be more efficient in how sort of things play out throughout the campaign. So we get the data for who's voted already. We can remove those people from a mailer, for example, or from a phone call. So you're not calling somebody who's already voted, obviously. And it helps you just, spend your money more efficiently, but also see where sort of patterns are happening as the voting is happening. Are we above or below where we think we should be in certain areas? And are the voters that we need to turn out actually, turning out? And we can monitor that leading up to the election.
Well, John, we'll get to some of the specific numbers that we've been seeing over the past week or so. But one of the things that's been a little bit controversial is some states have sort of moved in the other direction to sort of restrict early voting. A state like Pennsylvania, for instance, makes you have to sort of prove why you want to do an absentee ballot. Can you just talk about the state of play on that? Is it getting easier? Is it getting harder?
Yeah, I think there's been a definite drive by states with Republican secretaries of state and some legislatures to make it harder to early vote. North Carolina is the most glaring example where the legislature asked for racial data on who voted when, and when they found out African Americans tended to vote 3 weeks out, they tried to restrict it. Luckily, court stepped in and made that a little bit harder. But so in some places, we've seen it retrench. Democrats are trying to make that work a little bit faster. We moved Colorado under Democratic leadership, went to an all-male state. Every state really varies on this. Both New York and Pennsylvania, you have to vote on election day or you need an excuse. Same in Virginia. I think in general, Democrats like to expand early voting because we rely more on GOTV and on turnout of unlikely voters. And with early voting, we get 3 weeks to try to get people to vote instead of one day. So it gives us a lot more time to get out there and call folks and knock on their doors and get them to the polls.
So Mark, what's really interesting about that is the theory of the case that the as espoused by the Trump folks, insofar as they espouse the theory of the case, has been that they're going to bring in unlikelies, like people, you know, these Toledo, Ohio voters that we talked about in the primaries who were flipping over on the same day registration or whatever. Wouldn't it, if the Trump people had been sufficiently organized on the ground, couldn't they have taken just going by their own theory of the case, couldn't they have presumably taken greater advantage of same-day voting?
Well, one thing we've seen has been a trend this year of more and more independents voting early, at least even more so than in 2012 and 2014. So in states like North Carolina and some others, you have more and more folks who are independent voters, registered independents, who have decided to take part and vote early. So any campaign that's organized and can target those folks, model a likely, in this case, Trump supporter, and target them to vote early, yes, they could take advantage of that, of course, especially because you already have sort of a trend of those that larger pool of people voting absentee and voting early. So, but in absentee and early vote, one of the biggest things that you need to have is organization, and these things also cost a lot of money. I mean, you're doing mailers, you're doing door-to-door to fill out absentee forms. These are very, you know, labor-intensive processes, but also doing absentee chase and making sure the ballots come in. Those are all things that are very data-intensive, analytics-intensive.
And labor-intensive
and cost a lot of money. And it's part of the campaign. Part of a conventional campaign, you know, sort of ecosystem and sphere, but we, you know, you see things on the RNC, they're doing some of those things. I have not seen some of that from the Trump campaign so far.
So the RNC tends to be more competent in terms of doing the blocking and tackling, which is not a surprise. Was the Romney campaign particularly good at that?
Well, I was involved in the campaign. We were. I mean, we were focused on absentee and early vote. Yes, I think the short answer was yes.
Now, one of the big questions that people have is a couple of things. One of them is, are you increasing the pool, the overall electorate, versus, you know, cannibalizing your own same day?
Right.
What's the verdict on that? It seems to be a wash, right?
Yeah, so there's actually a lot of evidence that the Clinton campaign is doing it really well, bringing new people into the process. Some of that is because, as Mark was saying, it's a data-intensive, organization-intensive, and they've invested in it. You know, as of last night in North Carolina, 58,000 Democrats who didn't vote in 2012 have voted early, and only 38,000 Republicans who didn't vote in 2012. So there's some evidence that Democrats are doing a pretty good job of...
A state, we should say, that Obama won by 14,000 votes in 2008 and looks to be nip and tuck this year.
Yeah, and lost narrowly in 2012,
where
we've got a governor's race and a Senate race as well as the presidential. So there's evidence that, you know, right now almost 6% of the total vote in North Carolina are Democrats who didn't vote in 12. So it is making a big difference. I think the Clinton campaign really is focused like a laser beam on that unlikely voters, bringing new people in. You know, they'll put the vote early for everyone because it's nice to get them off their walk list and call list, but they're focused on Latino voters and focused on unlikely voters.
Let's break this down for a second for people who haven't read Sasha Eisenberg's great book and don't really keep track of this stuff. Let's talk a little bit about voter targeting and the kind of data. We were talking, I guess, before we started rolling tape on this about how the cloud has increased the amount of data that can be stored by campaigns. Give me a sense of how you're profiling these voters, particularly these low propensity voters that you're talking for. Tell me what, if you're on a campaign and you're organizing this stuff, what's on your dashboard about a particular person?
Yeah, so we've got lots of scores and models, and we can talk about issues and we can talk about behavior, but the two most important, we give everybody a score on how likely they are to vote at all from 1 to 100 and how likely they are to support a candidate. So a Clinton organizer in North Carolina would see, you know, Joe Smith, 50% likely to vote, 86% likely to support Hillary, and then that's a person that they want to change his behavior, right? They want to get, they think he's going to vote for Hillary, but they're not sure if he's going to vote, so we try and turn that person out. You know, two doors down, they may see someone has an 85% chance of voting and a 58% chance of supporting Hillary Clinton, and then that person becomes a persuasion target.
Okay, so what are the two different modes? So give me an example of, it's a great way to put it. How would you interact with those two different voters in different ways?
Yeah, so with the turnout target, you're trying to change their behavior. With the persuasion target, you're trying to change their opinion. And that's a very different conversation, and it's a very different set of tactics. Usually the best way to change someone's opinion is to hear from the candidate themselves, right? That's what most of your TV ads are focused on, what your rallies, the articles that get placed in the newspaper. You know, you want to hear what the candidate thinks about issues and about who they are. The best way to change someone's behavior, though, is to have folks who look like them, who understand them, to talk about the why the election's important more than why Hillary is the right candidate. So that's what the field, Democratic field efforts tend to focus on, those people where we get folks going door to door and calling to say, hey, I live here. This is important to me because of these key reasons. We're going to go vote early on Tuesday. You should come with us.
Okay, so we're talking about propensity versus candidate preference, propensity to vote versus preference. What's more expensive?
Candidate support is a lot harder to model because you have to call a lot of people and ask them. Likelihood to vote, we mostly use historic data. So we look at, if the person voted before, that tells us a lot more than if they say that they want to vote in the future. What we found is that people telling you they're going to vote is incredibly unreliable as a way, and people lie and say they're going to vote when they aren't, but they also lie the other way. The polling from GQR did a big analysis of its data and found that half of the people who told them they weren't going to vote turned out and voted in the 2012 election. They were just trying to get the pollster off the phone.
We did the same thing and found that as well.
So they used that as just a quick exit strategy.
Yeah, they thought it would be a way of being polite and having the pollster hang up, and it didn't work.
Asking someone to self-report, and this is part of, sort of the polling industry as a whole, asking someone to self-report, their likelihood to vote. When you do lay that onto a voter file, oftentimes it sends mixed messages.
So the likelihood, that's fascinating. So the likelihood to vote as a question, people... That's incredibly
dire. You'll have high propensity voters that'll tell you no simply because they just don't want to talk to the pollster.
So what do you do? Do like I do, a follow-up question where you say, oh, come on, really?
So we just stopped asking it on our surveys because we have vote history and we know if someone's going to vote or not. So we skip it.
This comes back to the question of, doing a list-based sample, building a turnout model sort of before you're doing your sampling for polling. And that's why a lot of times campaigns often have a little more tightly honed list that we're actually calling. It's just because we have the vote history, we have these other behavioral things that we're putting into the file.
Again, basic blocking and tackling, because a lot of people who follow this stuff really closely, I know what it means, but just explain to people in the simplest possible terms, what is a turnout model and how is it produced for a campaign?
So a turnout model is essentially saying how likely is this person to vote in a given election. So in this case, the 2016 general election. And as John referenced, most of the data that goes into determining if someone is likely to vote is based on their previous vote history. Right. There's also some elements of different data points that we can pull in if someone's a new registrant and, they fit a certain profile. Maybe they're older and they just moved into another state or something, and
is 19 whose parents have never missed an election is likelier to vote than someone who turned 19 whose parents aren't regular voters.
So essentially you're building a score or different buckets of folks that are either very high propensity or very likely to vote down to, not likely or not going to vote at all. So then you're able to range in between.
And so so a campaign then produces an Excel spreadsheet precinct by precinct about the number, providing them with a target number of people they think they need to deliver.
So every voter will actually receive a score of how likely that person is to vote. And then depending on what you're looking to do with it, whether it's, sort of come up with vote goals in a state or actually looking at a precinct and, like John said, finding those people who are maybe less likely to vote in that precinct, you want to send your walkers out to knock on those doors, and you want to combine that with, your candidate support score and find those people who are sort of persuadable in the middle who are less likely to vote. That's the list that you pull and send that, with your walkers to go and knock on their doors.
So if you've got a situation, so this is where resources are really important because the score essentially determines the investment, right? Mm-hmm. So if you've got a lot of money to do this and a lot of resources and a lot of volunteers and good training for those volunteers, you can reach lower and lower and lower into the propensity ladder, right?
Yeah, we always, the best person to talk to on election day, if you had the money to talk to one voter, would be someone with a support score of 100 and a turnout score of about 65.
Right.
Because that's where the point where you talking to them is worth more likely to get an extra vote. They're not so likely to come on their own, and they're not so unlikely that they're like, why are you bothering me with this? And then you radiate out from there in all directions. So then you go to people with 99% support, 65 turnout, 100, 63, and on and on and on.
And depending on your resources is depending on how far you can go.
So it comes back to the efficiency argument. How does data and analytics make a campaign or an organization or a corporate client more efficient in what they're doing?
Right.
And in the case of a campaign, just like John said, your first sort of most high value target, if you will, is that person who's very likely to support you but is not likely to vote. Okay, we need to focus the efforts there. Now, if you do have more resources, you widen the pool, you widen the net, and using data to be more efficient in direct voter contact is one thing. Doing the same in your media spending is very important. Doing the same in, you know, your mail program, your phone program, your digital program, all of those things, the efficiency and, of course, the data drives all of those things. As to, you know, we don't want to waste a bunch of money as a campaign. We want to talk to the people that we need to talk to with the $5 million, $10 million, or $100 million that we have to spend.
Now, one of the really striking aspects of covering 2012 was going and visiting the two headquarters, the Boston headquarters for Mitt Romney and then Chicago for Obama, two floors of the massive floors in the Prudential Center. And you see the same thing, incidentally, out in Brooklyn, two big floors full of people. And I was struck by how Romney's office looked like a fairly large, but not terribly large, insurance company, and how, you know, and how the Obama headquarters really looked like this huge, massive, sprawling trading floor. And it was simply because they focused more on GOTV, and they had those staffers and volunteers around. Why is it that explain that sort of gap between Democrats on GOTV and Republicans on GOTV. Is it just simply because Republican voters tend to be just higher propensity because they're older and more habituated to voting?
I think that, you know, I think that the success that the Obama campaign saw in 2008 has driven a lot of buy-in on the Democrat side to investing in those types of technologies. I think that on our side of the aisle, the Republican side of the aisle, there hasn't been as high of a sort of a, we haven't won the presidency, if you will, with data and analytics. And you haven't had the companies come out of the campaign organization, sort of the buy-in of high-level folks. You have some on our side, just not as many, where that has really sort of permeated throughout the ecosystem of the party. So I think that, you know, that is one thing that...
So it's cultural.
There is definitely a cultural.
And that culture goes back before the Obama folks. The Obama folks,
of course.
Sort of took it and elevated it to an art form.
Right.
But I do think that there's something that voters that are more likely to vote for Democrats are less likely to vote in general. It's why Republicans do better in midterm elections and we do better in presidential years. That there are a lot of folks out there that younger... people of color, immigrants, people, first generation Americans, tend to support our party, and it takes some work to make sure that they can be registered, that they know where to vote, they know how to vote, and when we have invested dramatically in that, and the Clinton folks have done a great job.
I don't think 2008 was the first success that either party had using data. I think that was a catalyst to, no pun intended, that was a catalyst to, you know, to not only build a talent pool from a campaign that really bought into it, but also, you know, just proved success to folks that maybe were a little more skeptical of the, you know, the techniques.
Yeah. But even before we had great data, in 2004, ACT was the largest private employer in the state of Ohio on Election Day.
Is that true? Really?
Yeah.
And tell people what ACT is.
The Americans Coming Together. It was in the pre-Super PAC era, a way to do turnout for progressives.
Was this Harold Dickey? This was Harold Dickey,
yeah,
who created that big voter file and kind of had a monopoly on it,
yeah,
and kind of lost it. And he was a big Clinton person. Clintons were a little late to this, actually. I think in 2008, they weren't nearly as savvy to it. But now they have a department over there, I think, of more than 100 data and analytics people. So in terms of, we'll get to the, I know I'm supposed to be talking about early voting, but this is good stuff too, and I don't think people really get it, and the way that these two are really tied in. So one of the things, I want to just get back to the Republican side a little bit, right? So Republican voters tend to be, if you're looking, and I don't want you to give away anything proprietary, if you're kind of looking, one of the real characteristics that I have found interesting about this election is that variable on support for Donald Trump by Republican voters, LVs, likely voters, has been bouncing around to a level that I had not seen this late in the campaign. Over the past, I'd say, week, and we don't know the impact, we should say we're speaking on the day that this email revelation just came out about Hillary Clinton and the FBI investigating new stuff. But we have seen the quote-unquote coming home phenomenon in the past 7 to 10 days, where you're starting to see Republican numbers approaching what are normal historical numbers. He's still a little low, 84%, as opposed to, I guess, was it 90 or 92% for Romney in 2012. But Are we then seeing, but in general, just if you're sort of looking at the overall thing, again, looking at the X and Y axes, right? Propensity versus support, right? To vote. Is Trump a guy who has a lower than average level of support, or and where does he sit on the propensity scale? Kind of analyze him in the historical pantheon of Republican candidates.
His supporters,
both in terms of from what you've seen in terms of data and the primaries, in terms of mm-hmm. their motivation to vote for him and their passion to support him.
Well, look, I mean, data. The first thing is public data that is out there, and not only nationally but in target states. Hillary's getting over 90% of Democrats. Trump is anywhere from sort of mid-70s to low 80% of Republicans. So there's obviously there's a gap there, first of all, of Republican voters who have sort of bought into supporting Trump. Now, as it relates to down ballot races, Senate, you see those Senate candidates who are Republicans running single digit points ahead of where Trump is right. to double digits in some states.
Unless you're Roy Blunt.
in Missouri.
So clearly there is a gap there that some Republicans have, and maybe that's coming home just this week. You know, the data still remains to be seen on that. I think, though, that his success that he saw in the primary was definitely a lot of the supporters that he did have was certainly a less traditional Republican, if you will, sort of people that probably were a little more low propensity. You saw record turnout
right.
in places like Iowa. When we went back and looked, though, at to see if those folks, you know, were growing the party, there were a lot of Republicans still that just didn't participate in the primary process before.
So these were lower propensity
primary voters. So what
kind of number would they have had?
Certainly they were less likely. Then more likely to vote in the Republican presidential primary.
Right.
Now, they were probably fairly likely to vote in the general. So those are people that are probably general election voters who just maybe had never caucused before or had never participated in the presidential primary before.
Oh, that's interesting. So his passion, from the analysis of the data that you could see, and granted, a lot of this is still fairly opaque, right? Mm-hmm. It seemed that you had regular or high propensity general election voters who were for the first time getting involved.
You look at a state like Iowa. You know, Iowa, I think it was 210,000 Republican caucus goers, the highest number ever in the state. And
we should say, Ted Cruz and his team did some very significant targeting.
Yes, they did. They did a great job on that. Yeah. And I think in a lot of these states, I mean, Donald Trump got more Republican presidential primary votes than any other candidate has. So he certainly was able to tap into a group there, but I think a lot of those folks, a couple firms and folks looked into that to see, okay, was he bringing folks in? And a lot of those folks were probably likely to vote in the general election anyway.
It's important, 210,000 caucus goers in Iowa, we expect 1.6 million votes in the general.
That's right.
So
yeah.
While it was huge turnout for a Republican caucus.
Teensy subset.
Yeah, it was just a small piece of the state.
We forget that for the amount of time that we spend in there because it's so funny. We spend months and months and months chasing those 200,000 votes and, a collective 2 days for the rest
right.
of the...
And looking at it in the general now, the Iowa early vote numbers are down from where they were in 2012 in terms of requests and returns. And we'll talk about maybe why that is, but, that doesn't always translate to excitement and...
There wasn't a single the turnout in the Republican primary was highest in New Hampshire, but it didn't come close. If you added every Republican primary vote together, they got much significantly less than Mitt Romney had gotten 4 years earlier in the general. That there was nowhere that the Republican primary was bigger than the regular general election Republican vote.
And do we have any sort of sense, again, sort of talking about enthusiasm? Do we have any metrics that we have seen about those core Trump voters who came out for him in the primary? Obviously, they have stuck with him. But has he really succeeded in generating enthusiasm among the Cruz voters or the Rubio voters? I mean, is it essentially a core of these white hot, no pun intended, Trump voters? And then the rest of them just kind of crazy gluing themselves to the Republican bandwagon because they're loyal.
Yeah, I think we haven't seen any evidence of that. We have seen some evidence that people who 4 years ago identified themselves as Republicans are now less likely to do that, right? That party identification isn't fixed over time, it changes. And I think we're seeing we do a lot of polling in suburban congressional districts, and the Republican Party ID is down.
It had been down to something, down to 27% self-identification nationally, which was an all-time low a couple of years ago.
And it's being driven down, but it's not equally across the country, right? We're seeing it really take a dip in a lot of suburban areas, particularly places where they relied heavily on college-educated voters who call themselves Republicans. There's just fewer and fewer of them. So what that means is that the voters who call themselves independents are getting more conservative because they're more likely to be ex-Republicans.
Okay, well, one more question on this, then we'll get to actual data because I know you guys are itching on that.
We do love data.
Whenever I would talk to Democratic field organizers, they'd always say, just as a rule of thumb, 2/3 of the people who self-ID as independents are Republicans in sheep's clothing, right? So is that still kind of the rule of thumb?
Yeah, we expect to lose the independent vote, but there's more Democrats than Republicans, so it works out. You know, Ohio is where I spent most of my time. You know, usually in Ohio, if the Democratic candidate can get 43% of the independent vote, then we're doing great. It varies a bit by the district, but...
Yeah. And she's running, according to even some of the tracking polls that have showed her not doing terrifically well. She's running very, very close with him. He's underperforming with Indies compared to Mitt Romney, right?
Right. And yeah, and the share of the independent vote, as it grows, it's not like we've just added 50 million moderates to the American electorate, right? Those are people who would have been lean Republican 4 years ago, and some of them have come to be independent. So you would expect that they would keep their policy ideas when they become independents. And
which is where the data sort of becomes even more important of understanding. Well, when you don't have that R or that D next to their registration, you know, what these folks look
so
like.
So it makes it much more, propensity is more difficult to figure out. I promise it's the last question on this, then we get to numbers. Why would somebody go from being an R to an I? Like, what motivates somebody to say, yet their behavior might be more equally as predictable in terms of who they're going to vote for? Why do people just take off that jacket?
Well, you know, I'm not a political scientist, but I think there's folks, the disaffection with the political process in some ways. I think the obviously there's record low approval of Congress and what's happening in D.C. And I think that voters have a tendency to, by identifying as an independent, it gives them that freedom, if you will, to... They may have a more conservative ideal than a liberal ideal, but it gives them that freedom, you know, to sort of push away what they're not happy with in Washington.
To give Washington the finger, basically.
Right. And so having that data to understand that person still may support a Republican candidate or Senate candidate or presidential candidate, it doesn't necessarily change their feelings on issues or their feelings about candidates as much as it would just their party registration, for example.
Because they tend to feel like they're not part of the system, which is exactly what the Trump phenomenon and what we've seen in sort of the Freedom Caucus thing. They're very hard to kind of define ideologically, but emotionally they're very easy to define.
Yeah, I also think it's amazing how many independents you talk to who say, oh yeah, I'm an independent. Well, have you ever voted for a Democrat? Oh no, of course not.
Right.
You know, there are people though who feel like we have prized this idea of I'm a free thinking independent. And if I'm a member of a party, if I say I'm a Democrat, that means I have to vote for all of these candidates. So there's definitely some, you'll meet some voters that think the answer should be I'm an independent. Whereas functionally, when it comes down to it, they agree with one party or another. Mm-hmm. They just don't like to say it out loud.
Has the Sanders phenomenon changed that on the Democratic side? Do you see mass groups of young sort of liberals and progressives and socialists sort of saying enough with D's, I'm ready to be an I?
So I don't know. There's a relationship there. I don't know if one caused the other. One of the things we found right after the primary is when we talked to folks who said they were Sanders voters who also said they were Democrats, 95% of them were like, yeah, Hillary's fine. We're happy to vote for her. When you talk to people who said they were Sanders voters and they were independents, that it was, you know, she had bigger challenges to overcome. She's done a lot of that, right? Those numbers have come way down. But I don't know if that's, I was a Sanders voter and I'm mad, so now I'm calling myself an independent, or if it came the other way around, that they had never thought of themselves as part of the party and were no more likely to.
And we should say that the first cohort of sort of the D's who were with Sanders is considerably larger than the
Sanders. Ironically, you know, the two states that Iowa and New Hampshire that start our political process off in the primaries have a huge percentage of independents who are registered in the states. And, you know, in Iowa, you have to be registered as a Republican to take part in the caucus.
Right.
So, and I think the same is on the Democrat side. So,
but you can change your registration on site. Yeah, as long as you're an independent.
But just it just shows you that, I agree with John and that the tendency to identify as an independent does give you that freedom, if you will.
Well, I have more questions asked just on that kind of thing, but I'm gonna stop because we have to talk about these numbers. Let's go from the macro to the micro, and jump in as you guys see fit. If we're gonna kind of at this point in time, I guess we've gone down the road in a few states like North Carolina and Florida. We're starting up in Ohio. Tell me kind of what, if you were to sort of give a macro general assessment, who's winning this, R's or D's, you know, where are we headed with the early voting and absentee?
Yeah, so as of last night, 16.35 million votes have been cast. Our modeling says that Hillary Clinton's winning them by 5.7%. So we're up overall. The votes that come in first are usually by mail. Democrats expect to lose those. Then we're starting to add in more and more early vote in person. Democrats expect to win that. What we've seen in places like North Carolina, we've eroded the traditional Republican advantage in the mail. And now as early vote in person gets there, that advantage is just growing. Democrats usually have an advantage in Iowa in the early voting. I think Republicans are catching up a bit there. But overall, there's definitely a Democratic advantage. With all these numbers, it's important to put it in context, right? That getting 60% of the vote when 4 years ago we got 62%, it sounds good to say we got 60, but it's actually not great. So when you dig under the hood, I think Democrats are doing a better job of getting unlikely voters to the polls and doing the hardest work of GOTV first. I think Republicans, what we're seeing in our data, and Mark may disagree, ballots that have been sent out, Democrats are more likely to have gotten them back in. The ballots sitting on America's coffee tables right now are more Republican than the ones that have been returned. And I don't know if that's hesitation about some people not wanting to vote for Trump. I don't know if that's, we have to research all the judges and all the water reclamation offices. But there's definitely been a lag in Republican ballot returns.
In the macro, compared to 2012, and again, this is not exactly a flat track because rules have changed from state to state, and there's a little bit of apples to oranges here. But if you were to just in the macro 40,000 foot level, how would you sort of qualitatively compare how Dems are doing now compared to 2012?
So I think you got to look state by state. We're doing much better in North Carolina. North Carolina is going tremendously well. We're doing really well in Arizona.
And North Carolina, we should say, on the first day, did this trend hold up that it was 55% women? Did that hold up throughout?
That has held up so far.
And I think actually as of today, it's actually surpassed what it was in 12, right?
Yeah. And in North Carolina, it's important. It's another way you have to put it in context. The laws changed pretty dramatically. And with the hurricane, with reduced sites early, you know, some of the Republican spin came, on this date, there were more folks, but there were also a third as many sites. So Right. Now we're pretty much up to speed. The places that are going to be open there are open. And Democrats are doing a terrific job. As I said, 58,000 registered Dems who didn't vote in 12 have voted in this election already. So that's fantastic. I think Democrats are doing really well in Nevada, are doing really well. In Florida, we're seeing us catch up. The mail vote in Florida is very Republican. It always has been. The in-person is good for us. What we've seen in Florida is that Latino turnout is just off the charts. And the Clinton campaign has done a phenomenal job of identifying Latino voters.
I saw numbers like 99% improvement in like...
on the first day.
Right.
Yeah, so... right now, 322,000 Latino voters in Florida have either requested or returned or voted early in Florida, which is 170% of the entire 2012 Hispanic early vote in the state. So
that's off the charts.
Really doing phenomenally well.
And that's a lot of that's in the I-4 corridor?
I-4 corridor and then Miami-Dade, particularly. It's hard, and whenever you're looking at Miami Hispanics, the difference between Cuban Americans and everybody else is pretty dramatic in their political opinions. So, there's a lot of digging that we can do. There's definitely more Republican votes in Miami and the Hispanic community than in other states. But
the sense is that this is a direct result of the organizing the Clinton campaign is doing?
The organizing the Clinton campaign is doing, plus the fact that it's made easier by a Republican nominee who is saying horrendous things about the Latino community.
Gotcha. Yeah, I would agree with John that it depends on the state. I think Republicans should feel pretty good about where they're at in Iowa, Ohio, Florida to a certain extent. I do think that... in those three, numbers are a little tighter than where they were in 12, a little better for Republicans than they were in 12. Iowa, Ohio, and Florida.
Oh, and Florida, I'm sorry. Oh, that's right, because Nevada is actually doing quite, Dems are doing quite well in Nevada, right?
Nevada's
I can tell from my John Ralston tweets.
a couple of states are sort of just very close to where they were in 12, and then I think I would agree, I think North Carolina is a state that we just have to keep an eye on, and these numbers continue to grow.
So if you're sort of kind of looking at it from, I'm a former tabloid reporter, okay? So you always go for the most extreme of the trends. If there's a headline of a state that's a wow state, We the consensus here is North Carolina at this point, right?
The Democrats are doing great. And the other one is Arizona. We think that Hillary is up 2 points in the votes that have been returned. Think about Arizona has a permanent absentee list, and Democrats for years have been investing in getting Democratic voters to register for this list. So 2.2 million ballots have been mailed out across Arizona. 96% of all the votes we expect in this election are already sitting on people's coffee tables.
Wow. In Arizona.
That's disproportionately Democratic and Latino. So the campaign now has a really easy, it's not an easy job, but we know exactly where to go. We know this voter got their ballot on this day, and we can go and call them and knock on their doors. And you know, you see Hillary's going to the state next week. It's a state that we're really taking seriously and investing in. But all of the years of planning that the Arizona Dems have done and other campaigns to fill this permanent absentee list, they call it the Pebble in Arizona, is having huge benefits right now.
So that means on election day, because you've got so many of this in your back pocket, what percentage of the Democrat voters would have voted by election day?
More than 75%.
Amazing. Yeah. So that means you can use you can take whatever staff and volunteers that you have and really, really target. And this would be where Donald Trump, not having invested in field and analytics, would really, really hurt him, right? You have a smaller subset of people, so you're going to have a fairly robust Democratic machine, and you've got down ballot races there to kind of fuel this. And there is synergy between the two, unlike on the Republican side, right? There's synergy between the local candidates and the national candidate. So this is where, in a state like that, when you're looking at numbers like that, that is where ground can really.
Well,
screw
the more
you.
The more of these votes that are banked away, and you can start shifting those resources, then yes, having the ground game, the bodies to focus on a smaller pool of folks is without a doubt gonna help.
And you regularly, on election day, you expect if you can get the person on the phone once on election day or answer the door once, that's your whole opportunity. In a state like Pennsylvania for GOTV, you get that one chop at it. If their ballot's sitting on the table, you can call them five times, you can knock on the door five times until you get that ballot returned. And we get the data every day, from the DNC, the Clinton campaign, our Senate and governor campaigns are seeing this almost in real time coming in. And every night the call list changes, every day the walk list changes, so that we can be not wasting a single door or a single phone call.
I think something John mentioned earlier to also just put in context is there are Republican ballots out there. Republicans tend to send those in later than Democrats do. So this week, probably this upcoming week, will be interesting to watch just to see what percentage. Iowa, we've seen the return percentage is lower than it was in 2012.
On both sides, or on the Republican side.
So it'll be interesting to see if that goes up. Hopefully it does. If it doesn't this week, then it will be time to deploy resources to hopefully get those ballots in the door.
And Ohio is obviously going to end, it starts next week, Ohio, right?
No, it started this week.
It started this week early voting.
Early voting, yeah.
And how long does it extend in Iowa, in Ohio?
It goes all the way through Election Day.
So it goes all the way through Election Day. And what have been the historic propensities in Iowa in Ohio in terms of the early voting?
So usually the mail leans Republican and the in-person is Democratic. This year, the Secretary of State, John Husted, sent a absentee ballot request form to every regular voter and left out a lot of unlikely voters. A bunch of Democratic state reps have sued him over this and are trying to get less likely voters to also get this mailer. So the mail request rate is way up over previous years. I don't know how much of that yet is of the returns are going to be replacement votes and how much is going to be new. But that universe is a little more Republican in the state because of who the state sent it to. One of the problems in Ohio is that every county is only allowed to have one in-person site. So if you have a Republican county of 10,000 folks, they get one site, whereas all of Cuyahoga, which is a sixth of the state's population, can only do it in one place in the center of Cleveland. So.
That'll be a 45-minute commute for people or longer.
Yeah, it's a long
Ohio's also a state, I think, somewhere between 30 and 40% will vote early, which is lower than a state like Arizona or Florida. And, you know, I think Senator Portman's campaign has done a really good job of identifying independents who would support him. And you've started to see that.
Well, he's sort of the
effect of a ground game on you know, the early vote numbers.
It is interesting that Portman, who I think we can, of all the Republicans who are up in this cycle in vulnerable seats, I mean, it's pretty clear that Portman has run the best operation, right? And he's got the best ground game and analytics game too, right? But he's divorced from he's entirely divorced from the Trump folks.
I think it shows the numbers and the effect that a smart analytics and ground game has on voting and on early vote and the impact that it can have in terms of being successful. Absolutely.
Okay, so I'll finish up. This has been a very, very helpful assessment. I'll finish up again with a little bit of macro and a couple of questions about kind of where things go from here on the actual election day, how this is going to work out. So if you're looking at all of this, and you were kind of had very little other data about the dynamic of the race, what would you sort of conclude about the two parties' enthusiasm and the directions that they're moving in?
So I think the fact that the ballots that have not been returned are more Republican than the rest of the country, that to me says that there's a Republican enthusiasm gap. I think looking at people of color are turning out in numbers that we've never seen, I think that speaks really well to the Democratic enthusiasm plus our organization. So,
though we have seen a lag, we should say, in Virginia has been very sluggish.
Well, mm-hmm. In Virginia, you need an excuse to vote early. Right. And so it's harder to run a program based on that, because in telling a whole bunch of folks that you don't know if they're going to be out of the state, you should tell your Board of Elections you'll be out of the state is a gray
right,
area.
Right, and everyone's telling everybody that the state's gone anyway. So,
right. I think that the contextual sort of analysis is important to look at state by state, because I do think there's different effects or different messages coming from different states. You know, a state like Iowa, the numbers are down on both sides. In other states, they're up on both sides, or up, you know, one way or the other, right, for one party or another. So I think it's hard to draw sort of, you know, big picture things from each of them. I think it's important to look historically at the context, but I think one of the messages is certainly that having data, effective data, like in Ohio, and a ground game to back it up, certainly has shown that it has an impact, without a doubt, on these early vote numbers, which, you know, nationally will make up 40% of the electorate.
Well, what's interesting also about Iowa, and I don't want to get off on a tangent, is the thing about in Iowa, it's essentially an all-white electorate. So you're not going to see the level of enthusiasm with Latinos and African Americans spiking that side of the equation. Yeah. So the double depression basically indicates the ambivalence that white voters of all stripes have about both candidates.
I do want to point out that Latino votes in Iowa are 160% of 2012 levels right now. So it's not a huge population, right, but we are seeing enthusiasm. And
that's largely in Des Moines, right? In the Des Moines burbs.
Yeah, what'll be fascinating for data guys like John and I is to see, number one, you know, do some of these votes that are still out there end up coming in, both as people with our party hats on, but also just as sort of practitioners of the craft. And number two, you know, what's sort of the overall turnout look like nationally and also in some of these states? And, you know, is it lower? Is it higher? I think that, you know, you do see some places where from both sides there may be some enthusiasm lacking, where maybe turnout ends up being lower than we think it is. And is that going to have an impact on the results? That still remains to be seen.
I guess the last question, because what we're talking about now, and again, we've sort of concluded in general that the jury is still out on whether or not we're cannibalizing or adding new voters. You just got to find out. Right?
Yeah, there's some evidence that most of the votes are replacement, but the new votes that are being brought in lean a little bit Democratic.
And this is your point about North Carolina.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're looking, we are, what, 11 days out? Mm-hmm. I wish we were one day out. We had some big news today. I don't know how big it'll turn out to be, that James Comey is looking into her emails again. And, you know, Hillary Clinton has not had a fantastic week. Otherwise, who knows what's going to come out about Donald Trump or what's going to come out of Donald Trump's mouth over the next couple of days. But essentially, we have we only have X percentage of the electorate that will be absorbing all this information and making decisions. First question, what percentage from right where we stand right now of the electorate is still in play? And these exogenous events, judging from where the consolidation of the polls, so I'm kind of asking you two separate sets of questions. First set of question is kind of on your analytics early voting side, which is, what percentage of votes are really in play? And the second question is more a political analysis, but also looking at the data. How can these external events, given that things seem to have consolidated and locked in on both sides, how big can these events really impact what's happening next? So I'll take each of you.
Yeah, so I think most folks who do polling off of voter files and do sort of analytics like both Mark and I do, what we're showing is that there's not a lot of voters that are in play. A lot of the float and the noise you see in national polling is response bias. It's right during the Republican convention, Democrats don't feel great about stuff, so we're less likely to take a survey. So it's a lot of the movement, and I think there's some great articles after the 2012 election where, you know, the Obama folks had their races very, very steady, and the public polling was all over the place because of differences in methodologies. I think we're seeing a lot of similar stuff here. From the beginning of this election, Trump had really high negatives. The votes have really been locked in. So, you know, I think there's been some things that have changed, that we saw some changes after the Access Hollywood video. But we're looking at maybe 6 to 7% of the population that hasn't completely rejected voting for the other party. And most of them have a strong opinion about who they'll vote for. I think the biggest piece is going to be turnout effect, right? That, mm-hmm. you know, if something comes out in the news, I hope it doesn't, I don't expect it will, that depresses Democratic turnout and makes folks feel bad, I think that's more likely than gets Hillary voters to say, I'm going to vote for Donald Trump now because of whatever they learn.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think give or take, I think around a third of the early votes that we would have expected or that we will expect to come in have come in already. So that means there's still two thirds of those folks, so that 40%, who have still not yet either sent their ballot in or gone to an early vote site. So now within that group, there's probably a very small percentage who are truly undecided right. and persuadable. So to what effect does news over the next week or 10 days actually have on that person right. getting in their car and going to an early vote site? I think that's the bigger question.
Right.
And also, what is the question of, for the folks that aren't planning on voting early, what does that affect on their willingness to go out and vote on election day?
And they are obviously, that cohort of people who vote on election day have a higher propensity to be undecided, right?
Yet independents tend to vote later and actual undecideds, particularly if they're undecided down ballot. A lot of the times you'll see people hold if they know that they're going to vote for Clinton, but they don't know if they're going to vote Republican for Senate or Democratic for Senate. Those people are more likely to wait and vote later.
And what will be interesting to see, and again, more of a political science experiment after the fact, is just going to look and see how many of those sort of mid and high propensity voters, and I don't suspect it will be a huge percentage, but it might, just sort of decide not to vote because they don't like either of their choices. And does that actually become reality versus just sort of a theory going into election day?
So if you're final question, if you're like looking at everything in the aggregate, if you're looking at the poll data, if you're looking at I asked you to go to 40,000, now I'm asking you to go to outer space. If you're looking at the aggregate of the poll data, the algorithms that the various Nates are cooking up mm-hmm. and the absentee versus the early voting, what does it look like to you? Does it look like the predictions? Does it look like a fairly substantial and solid Hillary Clinton victory? Or is there more ambiguity than you would have thought?
I think it looks like a very solid Hillary Clinton victory. I think the question on the Senate and on how big of gains in the House will come down to how many people are splitting their tickets, which the data doesn't show us yet.
Right.
But from you know, we know a lot about presidential behavior, and it looks, you know, like it's going to be an early night on election night from everything I'm seeing so far. Knock on wood and turn around three times.
Yeah, I think the next week or so will really, if some of these, the good news for Democrats continues to be good news for Democrats in some of these states like North Carolina, or if the good news for Republicans in some of these places dissipates, then I might agree with John there. But we'll just have to kind of see as this data is coming in over the next week to see where things end up.
And before I get a phone call from New York, that doesn't mean we should be complacent. Everybody go work hard and knock on doors.
But what is your, but looking, I just want to push you a little bit more, Mark. But looking at the data set that you're looking at now, and again on the macro, what does it look like to you? Do you agree with his conclusion that it's a fairly big win, or do you think there's a lot of ambiguity?
I think there's a little more ambiguity depending on, again, what happens over the next week. I think some of these places...
In terms of voting or in terms of news
In
events?
Terms of voting, but in terms of, news as well. I think you still have, you only have a third of those folks who would have voted by now have voted. So right. you have a large percentage who will or who would have voted over the next 9 days, 10 days. It remains to be seen what the story today will have, what impact that will have, and like you said, what might happen from Trump, and what that's a big unknown about what will happen over the next week. So those could have shifts in the data. I think the trending of some of these states certainly favors, I think, the Clinton campaign in some of the places where they need to do well.
And again, she has a much wider, we should just say in general, as the ambient.
The pathway is fairly tight for Donald, right. for Donald Trump. And I think
if North Carolina is gone, his chances are essentially gone unless he picks up an unexpected state somewhere else. Right. So essentially what we're dealing with here is, but the takeaway here is the people who are lingering, the people who do not participate in absentee and early voting, are, to the extent that there are persuadables, more as a percentage persuadable.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. So,
and more prone to the news cycle stuff.
And right, those will make up the majority of people that do vote in the cycle. So the early vote data is an important tell as to what's happening. But a lot can happen over the next week or 10 days.
And yeah, so, we're telling all our clients, like, what we see in the early vote isn't going to change the fundamentals of the election, but it's an indicator of how organizations are and how the strength of the various campaigns. I think it tells us a lot about that, and I think it's a good sign for...
I think, yeah, the both campaigns, but also all these Senate campaigns, I mean, they need to get to a certain number in the early vote in order to be successful overall in the election. And so... We're early enough in that process. We've still got 10 days to go in the early voting, where some of these big news stories could impact that, but we'll just have to find out.
Well, I hate ambiguity. I wish you guys were just going to slam the door for me so I can go home and go to sleep. But guys, it's been incredibly useful, and thanks so much for taking your time.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.